Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and I'm joined today by someone who's been in the entertainment business for well over 40 years now. You wouldn't recognise his face necessarily because he's worked behind the cameras, directing TV programmes including Parkinson, Top of the Pops, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, The Weakest Link, and I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. So I'm pleased to welcome Ian Hamilton. When you're directing these highly prized programmes, can you just tell us what the role of the director is?
The role of the director is basically to organise what you see on the screen. So the director will be in charge of the cameras, selecting which shots go on air, whereas the producer, for instance, looks after more of the editorial content, budgetary things, things like that. The best bit is when a director and producer work well together, and then it's an absolutely lovely event. The best thing is when you're a producer-director, then you get to win all your own battles. I'm responsible, basically, for getting something on the air, so I will plot 10, 15 cameras, whatever it is, work out what we're going to do, and then it goes to air like that.
And if push comes to shove, who wins between the director and the producer?
Well, technically, the director is the ranking officer in the studio on that day. These days, I suspect the producer would win.
And you select, presumably, all the team that you work with, the cameraman and the rest of the team?
Yes, I'll select the designer, the lighting director, cameramen, floor management, right down to costume, makeup, all that sort of thing. The great relationship is if you've got a good relationship with a producer and you do it together and you use the same people that you like, and then it all becomes terribly easy.
Now, you began back in the early 1970s, and you started at the Bristol Old Vic, and I think you were in stage management there. So what sort of useful grounding did stage management in a theatre give you?
Well, it actually goes back a little bit. It goes back 5 years before that when I was a stage manager at Glyndebourne Opera. And it goes back even further than that. My parents got me interested in string puppets. I used to run a puppet theatre when I was 13 and 14. We sold all the puppets and bought a film camera, made amateur films. I was then precocious enough to have had all my A-levels just after my 16th birthday. And in those days, I had to take a year and a half out before I went to university. So I worked for Glyndebourne Opera as a stage manager, which was just the most amazing time, you know, in the 60s down in Sussex. I was then persuaded, I'm glad to say, by my parents to actually go to university because Glyndebourne had offered me continuous employment thereafter. But I'm very glad I did university. I did modern languages at university, lots of theatre at university. Then graduated on a Friday and started at the Bristol Old Vic on a Monday.
And was it a useful grounding in terms of the duties of a stage manager to pursue what you then went on to do?
Oh, massively, yes. A stage manager in theatre is the equivalent of a floor manager in television. And you have a lot of responsibility. In theatre, you're running a show. In television, the floor manager is running the studio floor and is the director's mouthpiece, effectively. And in theatre, you're the theatre director's mouthpiece to a certain extent when you're running the show.
You switched from the Bristol Old Vic to Bristol Television because there are significant studios still in Bristol. And it's very well known, of course, now for the Natural History Unit. With some of the programmes that you produced, I think you did Animal Magic with Johnny Morris. Yes, there's a voice from the past. And things like Fox Watch and Badger Watch, did they come under the umbrella of the Natural History Unit then or not?
Well, when I went to Bristol, I was so lucky. I had a man who was the regional television manager, which was a typically BBC type of designation for someone, called Jimmy Dewar. And he got a real kick out of pushing everyone he employed on to do other things. And I joined BBC West, which is the local news, Points West. I joined as a holiday relief station assistant for a month, which meant I was floor managing, painting the scenery, looking after the picture library, doing the sound effects for the local news and things like that. Within 8 months, I was directing the news and vision mixing the news. But Jimmy would just go to the bar and blag a producer from the Natural History Unit and say, "You ought to be using Ian." And so 2 years after joining the BBC, I was directing Animal Magic. Then when we did Fox Watch, I was doing that more on a sort of ad hoc basis because the foxes in question were actually in a basement underneath the BBC in White Ladies Road. And the cameramen used to say to me, "If we'd build a flat over Studio B, you would live there, wouldn't you? Because you love it all so much." And I did. And so I just blagged myself onto doing Badger Watch. And that was fascinating because that was the beginning of infrared cameras and things like that.
It sounds like a sort of precursor to Spring watch an autumn.
Oh, absolutely.
A little bit.
Yeah, yes. It was.
Especially and if they were right down below you in the basement.
And it was uncharted territory. And, you know, I'd finish directing Points West and then stay in the control room until 3 o'clock in the morning just watching the foxes and helping organise the cameras for that.
And then you switched to things like Top of the Pops in London. I mean, that was a huge programme. I can remember, had to watch it.
Yes, Top of the Pops and indeed Parkinson were just massive shows
in
the 70s.
Yes, really big. So what were they like to work on?
Completely fascinating and very much sort of by the seat of your pants. You would only know what was going to be on the show on Tuesday evening. The show was recorded as live Wednesday evening. So you'd have a load of PAs or script supervisors doing what we call breaking down songs, which is getting the lyrics and the bars of music and things like that. So the director could do a camera script. So you would do quite often a lot of camera scripts on spec for stuff that wouldn't be used. And then on Tuesday morning, I think it was, that's when the charts came out. And that's when the producer would decide who was going to be on the show, basically. And you'd always want, for instance, the number one. You'd always want someone who was going up the charts very quickly. You would then spend the rest of the day scripting all the songs, because the songs would be completely scripted. Go into the studio Wednesday, you would have the only copy of the script, because you'd handwritten it all. And so before each song, you'd give out all the shots. You know, camera one, you've got a close-up of the singer, all that sort of stuff. You'd rehearse it, and then at 7:30 Wednesday night, you recorded it. You would generally not edit it. In those days, editing was very, very expensive. You would just shoot it.
As live, basically.
As live, and then it would go out Thursday night, following day, just in case there were things you had to fix.
Immediately, in that sort of scenario, you're into dealing with people who, you know, they are celebrities, of lots of big egos around there. It's quite tricky to handle, I guess.
I don't think I was as aware of that then as I probably am now. We didn't have the sort of J-Lo moments where she, you know, J-Lo likes to have a dressing room painted pink or whatever, and, you know, 10,000 orchids and things like that. We didn't have that level of diva-ishness. The bands would, you know, as long as they had some booze in the dressing rooms, that was fine. And you get the occasional fight between a couple of bands who didn't like each other. But other than that, there was not enormous diva-ish behaviour, I don't seem to remember.
And you also did 3 Royal Variety performances. Mm. Those, again, were the sort of thing of the year, weren't they? A huge enterprise to undertake as director in charge of that.
Yeah.
How far ahead do you start planning something like that?
Well, it's quite interesting we're talking about that, because I was interviewed for a TV show about the 1989 Royal Variety Show, which I did, and which did 60 million viewers. I believe I'm still the only ITV person to produce and direct a Royal Variety. All the rest, they have a separate people. BBC used to have just one person doing it all. But I started work on it the night of the previous one. I was sitting in the London Palladium with my boss, Marcus Planton, who was the controller of entertainment, and he just turned to me and said, you know, do you want to do next year? Because in those days, ITV and the BBC used to alternate. They don't anymore. ITV just does them now. And so I said, yes, of course. And it was a year off and on in the planning.
Can I imagine? And how did you decide who you were going to go for?
You go through a sort of short list of people, and you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And I decided I wasn't going to use comics that had been on the show, for instance, before. So I wasn't going to use the Jimmy Tarbucks, Bob Monkhouses, however great, and they are great people. I was going to go for more modern talent. And of course, I then went for people that, because I'd also just a year before been doing Saturday Live with Ben Elton. So we had a lot of the younger, you know,
up-and-coming,
satirical copy,
yes.
All that.
Yeah.
You know, the alternative was the word. Mm. So I put a couple of those in. And of course, I got an enormous amount of flack in the papers saying, well, why didn't you use Jimmy Tarbuck and Bob Monkhouse? If I'd put them in, I would have got flack saying,
for not using them.
You know, so you sort of construct different scenarios. And in particular, we decided to do a tribute to Las Vegas, a big undertaking. It was about 20 minutes of the show. And we flew to Las Vegas and Los Angeles and amazingly secured the services of Sammy Davis Jr., who actually said, oh, and I'll link the whole show as well. So I came back to London Weekend Television and was sort of carried through the corridors on the shoulders of staff, because what a great booking. He hadn't done it for about 20 years. And then we were building the show around him. And I went in one morning and someone said to me, have you seen the Daily Mirror today? And there was a tiny little column saying, it's been confirmed that Sammy Davis Jr. has throat cancer. We were in close contact with his agent and we rang up and we said, look, we understand all the problems. And you know, if there's anything we can do, we just love him to walk on once, you know, we'll fly him in a private jet, whatever. But he was actually too ill by that point. And she said, no, there's no chance at all. So we'd lost our top of the bill. And so,
and how close to transmission?
Oh, this was only sort of a month before the show, which is actually a very short amount of time when you're planning a 3-hour show. And so we looked around, and I'd worked with Barry Manilow quite a lot. And obviously it was someone who would be synonymous with Las Vegas. So we looked at lots and lots of people, and most of them were unavailable. But Jerry Lewis was available. And when we did the show, we discovered why he was available, because he wasn't terribly funny, I'm afraid to say. He came and turned up with a book of different routines, and he said, which one would you like me to do? We made him quite funny, but we were able, through some rather judicious editing, because we also had Tina Turner on the show, we actually made her the top of the bill, and she was brilliant. Jerry was disappointing. He was quite old by then. He just came along and went through the motions. It was a real disappointment, because I'd been a great fan. And that show, again, you turn around within 2 days, so you're editing a 3-hour show. I think we shoot it on a Monday, and it used to go out on the Wednesday or Thursday.
Were there times when things just went disastrously wrong as you were supposed to be filming for live and you had to pull out all the stops and retrieve the situation?
Yeah, I guess there are always times when that does happen, although probably less than you'd think. And it's actually one of the great things about being a director. And that's the director, as much as anything, is being paid a bit like an airline pilot. You're being paid lots of money for when things go wrong. I used to do a lot of news as well for ITN and the BBC, and that was always very last minute, and things were always going wrong then. I remember one time I was doing ITN News at 10, I think it was, and we had Prince Edward watching. And miraculously for journalists, because Prince Edward was in, all the stories were in and everything was rehearsed and it was all perfect, unlike what normally happens when it all comes together at about 10:35 or something like that. But we had a piece of video from Beijing of Mrs. Thatcher, and it kept dropping out and picture disturbance, and all the journalists were shouting at me, stay with it, stay with it. And I'm saying, I've got to get off this. And it was one of those situations where it was just like dominoes. Everything went wrong from there on, with Prince Edward just standing behind me saying, oh, this is a bit of a hairy show. You know, it happens, and that's all part of it.
When you did a programme like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, tension of a different sort, mostly for the contestants, which you sought to sort of heighten by the dreadful gaps that you left, you know, before the answer came out. Were you involved at all with the guy in the audience who kept coughing clues?
That show happened with another director, and I happened to join 2 days later. The interesting thing about that was that it was obvious that somebody was going to try and cheat, because it was a lot of money. But we thought it would be much more high tech. And for instance, the show was shot at Elstree. And if you went and sat in the Tesco car park next to the studios, and you had a very, very basic radio scanner, like a lot of journalists will have with the police wavelengths, you could have tuned in to my control room. So you would have heard every single question being asked. You could sit there with a laptop computer, and we assumed that perhaps the contestant in question might wear an earpiece, which could have been concealed by long hair. And we thought, you know, what's the capital of France? You Google Paris, and you say, it's Paris. And you could answer the question. But it was, in the end, it was much more low tech. It was only two people coughing. And the sound supervisor on the show, who was a very, very close friend of mine, he had to go to court. And he and everyone said, if they bailed out at £500,000, they would have got away with it. Okay. It was only the question for the £1 million was such a U-turn. He gave one answer, there was a cough. Then he gave another answer, and it was so diametrically opposed to the answer he'd given. That's what alerted them. And of course, all the microphones in the studio are recorded separately, so they were able to isolate one block of audience, and that was it.
Yes.
But he could have got away with £500,000.
And then you did, by contrast, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I often wonder who dreams up the ghastly tasks that the contestants have to deal with.
Yeah. I only did the first series of that, which was the sort of, I'd like to think of as the groundbreaking series. And we were making those things up almost the night before. Nowadays, it's done by a completely separate team with a separate director, whereas I was up doing the main show with Ant and Dec, then I would then stay on for another 2 hours, do the Bush Tucker trial, and then go home. Nowadays, they have a whole complete team doing it, and they spend a lot of money on them because a lot of the props and things like that are massively complicated. I remember vividly the producer getting very worried that we were going to dump a load of cockroaches on Tara Palmer Tomkinson. And actually now that seems completely tame.
Really? Yes, I was going to say.
You know, and we buried the comedian Rona Cameron. We buried her in a coffin. She was one of the first ones to say, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. But we were very tame, I think, with what we did compared with, you know, we didn't do all the eating of the really unpleasant things.
No.
But enormous fun to do. And one person said to me, "You're shooting this up at Pinewood, aren't you, in Hertfordshire, because it looks too good." And we were 9,000 miles away in the middle of nowhere.
Literally in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, we had to have satellite phones because there was no mobile phone coverage. We'd built a road into the bush. It took me from my hotel an hour and a half every morning to drive to the location. They put in a whole infrastructure of, obviously, of lavatories and offices and things. All that had to be taken away and the whole place returned to what it looked like, because we were on the equivalent of National Trust or conservation property. We were hardly allowed to cut down branches and things. When I went to plot all the cameras, if I wanted to lose a branch, we had to get permission for it to be cut down. You know, the lavatories and things all had to be taken away. And originally we were going to not have lavatories for the celebrities. It was going to be completely genuine.
In the bush.
Yeah. But the Australians said, you can't do that because what those celebrities are producing might get in the water supply. Quite rightly, because there was a stream. If you remember the first series in 2002, there was a river going around the back of Anton Deck. So we were very, very near to a water supply. So that's when they came up with the idea of it's effectively like a portaloo.
The budget for these programmes must be huge.
Absolutely massive. Still not as massive as drama. And I think I'm a Celebrity has got cheaper and cheaper. And now they've been in the same location since 2003. We were up in Queensland near Cairns. They're now just north of Brisbane. And they've had that same location. So obviously all those costs come down quite a bit. But it is a massively, massively complicated.
And that's your concern too, as director.
Yes, you get lent on. You turn up at a meeting for a show and the production manager, particularly these days, will say, well, of course, you've only got six cameras to do this. And you say, well, hang on a sec, I've not even had a look at the set and I don't really know what the show is about. I might need eight cameras. Oh, you can't have that.
Working in the entertainment business as you have, you work with the same people a lot of the time. You get to meet a huge number of people. Have any become personal friends?
Oh, yes. I did the Brian Connolly show for a long time and Brian's a good friend.
It's a strange sort of line, isn't it, between your professional relationships going over into personal friendships, if you like.
I don't think you ever become a friend like a normal friend, you know, in civilian life, as it were.
Yes.
I'm very friendly with a lot of people, but not to say we'll come round for a drink or something like that. You know, I worked with David Frost for a long time from TVAM days, and I considered him a mate, and I would get Christmas cards, invitation to the fabled summer garden party and things like that. But he was more a working friend, I think, is the best thing. He was also the nicest man in television, I'm bound to say. He was just the most wonderful person. Charming. If he was sitting here, he would make you feel like the most important person in his life. He was just the nicest man and a very astute businessman. You know, he founded Breakfast Television. He founded London Weekend Television. He had a fantastic company, Paradigm Productions. If all he'd done in his life was interview Richard Nixon, that would have been pretty good. And yet he would be happy to do Through the Keyhole as much as he was interviewing Richard Nixon. He was a great man of the people, and he was just great. I can't, such a fan, and it was just tragic when he died. There were years more left in him, I think.
Now, your work's taken you all over the world, but home for you, I think I'm right in saying, is Hertfordshire.
Yes, home has been St Albans since 1983.
So what's so attractive about this area? Is it the commuting distance to London?
Well, I'm bound to say, you see, it is, because I used to live in Bristol when I was obviously down doing stuff for the BBC. Then I went freelance in 1980 and sort of moved around a bit. And a colleague of mine said, we were working at Granada in Manchester, and he said, why don't you just come and spend the weekend in St Albans with my wife and I? So that was a very nice weekend, and I thought, this is a very nice city. And I was born and bred in Chichester, which is a cathedral city again, like St Albans. And I think cathedral cities have a certain atmosphere all their own. And I did think, yes, well, I can get into London very quickly. I can get to Birmingham, Manchester. The M25 hadn't been built at that point, although it was very, very shortly afterwards. So I could get down to TVS in Maidstone and things like that. You know, Watford Station, very good for the train. And so that was as much as anything why I moved here. And it's a wonderful place to live, absolutely.
Thank you very much, Ian Hamilton.
It's a pleasure.
Coming along and having a chat today.
Great pleasure, thank you.